Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Victoria Lupashko, your host for today's conversation with Dr. Yudhia Zhu, who is part of the Australian National University's Research School of Humanities and the Arts. Hello, Dr. Zhu, and welcome to New Books in Asian Studies channel. Thank you for agreeing to talk to us about your new book, Heritage and Romantic Consumption in China, published by Amsterdam University Press and part of the International Institute for Asian Studies series.
Hi, Victoria. Nice to meet you. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss my book here.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to get into the details and to hear you speak about it in more details. And, you know, I'll start the interview by asking you, to getting to know you and your work better.
Sure.
And I was wondering whether you could please tell us how you came to this project. You know, what got you interested in Yunnan, in the Lijiang area, in heritage and tourism studies in general?
Sure. Thanks for that. In 2005-06, I was offered a UNESCO fellowship to study the relationship between heritage and tourism in Lijiang. So just give you a quick overview. Lijiang is a city in southwest China, 600 kilometers from the capital of Yunnan, Kunming, and not far from Laos, Burma, and Vietnam. And in early days, this is a remote area in which many adventurers and explorers, mainly Westerners, were attracted by its mountain sceneries, waterways, wildlife, and traditional architecture, and ethnic minorities and religious culture. So during my first visit to Lijiang in 2005, like early adventurers, I was also attracted by the beautiful scenery and the exotic ethnic minority culture. So I'm basically like a tourist. So I was wondering when I saw so many tourists and investors and migrants to come to this place. I was wondering why this place has attracted so many people, including me as one of them. And how does such development, I mean, so many flow of people and the capitals, change the local society? And what does this change mean to these tourists and the local communities? I think these questions become the main reasons that I start to study this place.
That's great. And it's very... It's very fascinating to think about how we get attracted to these areas and how the organization in these areas change their essence, in time.
Yeah.
And I think your book does a tremendous job at going into details about it and showing exactly what you described. It's a book that is comprised of a prologue, the introduction, five chapters, the conclusions, and an epilogue. And in the introduction, you mention a few of the questions that influence the thinking about this book. And here I'll quote the questions. So what is the nature of ethnic tourism and heritage? Why does it change local society so powerfully? And what are the insights, what insights do the social context of tourism and heritage provide? And from these questions, we can start to figure out the book's main themes. But I wanted to invite you to tell us more about the key concepts. And here I'm thinking about heritage, ethnic tourism, romantic consumption that you explore and in the book. And also you show how they're interconnected. So, I was thinking if we could hear more about them.
Sure. As you said, there are three key concepts associated with the book's main topics: heritage, ethnic tourism, and romantic consumption. The first one is heritage. When we talk about heritage, we often think about antiquity, historical buildings, monuments, and ancient objects in the museums. And these days, we also include folklores, arts, performance, and religious practice. So these books include, but also go beyond all of these tangible and intangible elements. I approach heritage, or more precisely, cultural heritage, as a social process of human action to construct the past. So, but it's not only about the past. As Dawei Lowantow and others indicated, all heritage is about the present. So these days, especially after the Second World War and the development of urbanization, industrialization, cultural heritage has become a global industry. So it becomes, as Laura Jean Smith phrased, as authorized discourse, that the ways we understand the past are shaped by authorities, professionals, and experts. So in one word, heritage is not only a thing, heritage is a process of making of the past for the present. So the second term of the book is ethnic tourism. This is a term might refer to a special form of tourism that is associated with custom of indigenous or aboriginal people, such as Eskimos, Inuits, or San Blas Indians of Panama. So sometimes it also refers to aboriginal or indigenous tourism, although these terms might mean different things in different regions. So apparently ethnic tourism has some colonial legacies, and it is a political project. So each nation, no matter what their position at the global political table, promotes ethnicity as a means to legitimize itself as a territory entity. So ethnic tourism served the role to objectify and museumify this ethnic culture, their customs and objects, and separate them from daily life and create it for external consumption. So now there's a particular context of ethnic tourism in China that is associated with its ethnic policies or ethnic classification system. So we need to go back to 1950s when China was inspired by the Marx and Lenin's and Stalin system, which defined nationality based on common language, territory, and economic life. So China developed a national project, classified more than 400 self-identified ethnic groups into 55 ethnic minority groups. So in addition to the majority of Han Chinese, like me, I'm the Han Chinese, that is about 92% of the population. The remains of the 104 million people belong to one of the other ethnic groups. So we call them Naxi, which is the main ethnic minority of this book, or Miao, or others, or Tibetan, for instance. Sure. Some scholars describe the project as a kind of internal colonialization, because there's a power imbalance between the Han Chinese and the other ethnic minorities. So the result is, while Han Chinese are modern and civilized, the other ethnic people are branded as backward, exotic, and sometimes a bit feminine. So the ethnic tourism played an important role in such image buildings. So when we ask the question why Chinese tourists are interested in ethnic tourism and visit these remote ethnic minority areas, this question refers to the third notion of the book, romantic consumption. So by romantic consumption, if I put it in a simple way, I mean, I'm talking about people's dissatisfaction of urban life that leads to a romanticized interest in the natural and spiritual and aesthetic elements. And my notion of romantic consumption was inspired by Colin Campbell's idea of modern consumption. It refers to a modern attitude of longing triggered by dissatisfaction with the present and eagerness to indulge in new experience of pleasure and hedonism. So for instance, in modern China, the idea of romantic consumption refers to three main reasons here. First, the emergence of individualism, that people have more choice than before to pursue happiness and lifestyle. Second, a material consumption culture, especially in the urban sphere. So people are buying more things than the past. They can buy a lot of things in the markets and shops than before, have limited resources. Third, the idea of happiness has shifted from emphasizing material factors such as housing, clothes, and cars to more emotional experience. So just give you an example. So people like to celebrate Valentine's Day or go to the pub during the weekend instead of just going to the shopping. So these three reasons, the emergence of individualism, the idea of material consumption, and emphasizing on experience for happiness, leads to the phenomenon of romantic consumption in modern China that help us to understand why people are interested in visiting Lijiang as part of their experience. So these are the three main key concepts of the book: heritage, ethnic tourism, and romantic consumption.
So absolutely fascinating to hear about these things. And, you know, also to, I think one thing that comes out of reading your book is the idea that, you know, we can become more self-conscious of our own, you know, travel plans when they will be possible again, and what we, why we traveled right in the past to see the stone forest, for example, in Kunming, or, you know, the panda zoo, you know, or something, something else. And, you know, to also realize that it could be a sign of the times, right, of with globalization and with this emphasis of on, you know, neoliberal practices of time and consumption, then, you know, we get phenomena like this. But before I get, ask you more other questions about the book, I'd like to pose a different type of question, and that is about the research itself, specifically your methods and the ways in which the book took shape as you continued to visit Lijiang over the years.
First, as a Han Chinese researcher and being overseas for many years studying heritage and minority area of China, I and also my researchers and other people consider myself both insider and outsider. What does it really mean, insider and outsider? So when I went to Lijiang, especially during the first several years, so first several times, people in Lijiang, both the local communities and the tourists, feel that I might be part of them because I speak Chinese. And also, I learn a bit the local dialects and also learn a bit local culture. For instance, we drink a lot. Sometimes they offer me smokes, cigarettes, because it's a very ethnic minority area. They drink and smoke. But a lot of times, they also feel that I'm different. They sometimes feel that I'm also foreigner, even not a kind of foreigner in a foreign sense, but at least foreign to them. So I'm consider myself both this kind of insider-outsider position. That's one point. And second point, talking about methods, I was trained as an anthropologist, which is a Western anthropologist, which requires to stay with one community for a long time and study their culture and social life. So to get a sense of being there is very important for us. So we need to hang out with both the local communities and visitors in the daily life. So it's easier to hang out with local communities if you stay long time with them. So getting familiar with them and drink and work with them in the workspace, drink tea in the tea house, shop together in the local market. Sometimes it's a bit difficult to hang out with visitors because they feel that you are a stranger. Why you always chase me? So it's getting more and more a bit tricky that to hang out with the visitors. So I start to make friends with new migrants because they stay there for a bit longer time. Although they are not local Nashi, but they become part of them. So you have a bit more time to know them. So from 2006 to 2011, I realized if I stay there for only one shot of visit for a long time, it doesn't really work out. So I visit almost each year. Each time I stay there for 1-2 months, and sometimes 3-4 months. And during each visit, I met and catch up with old friends, and also meet new people and make new friends. So a bit different from the traditional anthropological way of staying a place for 1 year, such repeated visits allowed me to understand the impact of Herodian tourism on people's various stage of life. So just give you a more clear view. As the topic of the study eventually focused on weddings, I stay at the Nashi Wedding Courtyard, which is the main place of the study. So I saw many wedding performances. I hang out with those performers and visitors who I know during the weddings, and then later we become friends for a short period. I also witnessed many couples who got married or visited Lijiang, fell in love, got married in the wedding courtyard. Some of them had children and started a new business. And after 2-3 years, or 3-4 years, later they might depart from Lijiang for another stage of life. So I almost see a short kind of cycle of their life during that particular period of time. So that's going to give you a quick overview of my research method.
A very good overview, I would say, because, you know, it also sounds quite interesting to me, right, to be able to see these changes in, you know, in your environment and in people, and to be able to analyze it, but also participate to a certain extent. And, you know, it gives, you know, the reader a better kind of a better grasp, right, of the book and the way you organized it, right, as a performance, mm-hmm. right? And now I understand better why the chapters are named the way they are, and we'll get to each of them shortly. And we'll start with chapter 2, which is called Stage, is entitled Stage, and follows the history of heritage development in Lijiang. And you show how this location has actually changed in the past few decades in tandem with the evolution in consumption and tourism patterns. So this development has left a deep mark in Lijiang, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but also by extension in other places, these changes can be seen quite easily. So I would like to invite you to tell us a bit more about how Lijiang became, as you call it, a theater of heritage.
I'm very glad that you mentioned about theater. As the structure of the book is carefully designed to align with the theme of study, and the idea of theater was inspired by Evan Goffman's idea of social life as a performance, in which actors interact on the stage following a particular script, the physical settings, the context, and the prescribed manner of their roles. So in one word, life is like a stage. As you said, this chapter, I set up the stage of theater. And here the stage, the idea of stage, has twofold in meanings. First is the metaphorical stage, which refers to the city of Lijiang. So in response to national policies promoting heritage and ethnic tourism, the image of the place has undergone a process of making and remaking. So I mentioned earlier that after Western explorers, swayed by colonial nostalgia, present this place as an oriental paradise in the 90s, when tourism was developed in this region, it almost became a mecca for Western backpackers. And then on 3rd February 1996, an earthquake struck the region. And right after the earthquake, the place was recognized as UNESCO World Heritage Site. This is very important, which make it even more popular to many domestic Chinese. And the government used the post-earthquake reconstruction as an opportunity to recreate a built environment to match early 20th century image of Lijiang. So what we see Lijiang, if you visit there, is different from 1990s. It's kind of imagined early period of Lijiang, a kind of reconstruction. Mm-hmm. It's an image of frozen and timeless ethnic culture, has been used and represent in documentaries, films, theme parks, shops, museums, everywhere. So that's the first idea of the stage, a metaphorical idea. And the second meaning of the stage is the stage of the Nashi Wedding Courtyard. As I said, Nashi Wedding Courtyard is the main place of the book locates. It's a place where the local heritage office turned the local Nashi culture into a form of heritage for display. And here we are talking about a real stage, where local actors, the Naxi people, perform Naxi traditional wedding ceremonies for the tourists, who mostly are young couples on their honeymoon trips or migrants from other places, got married in Lijiang. So I would say the stage of the Naxi wedding courtyard is the microcosm of the broader stage of the Lijiang. So these two meanings of stage interact with each other in an interesting way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
They certainly do. And actually, I didn't know before I read your book that Lijiang was rebuilt and followed this sort of imagined, right, or memory, right, helped a lot to rebuild Lijiang.
Yeah.
In that sense. So that's very interesting. And of course, as you mentioned, it accommodates, right, weddings, and you know they're part of this ethnic tourism, right, as well. And in chapter 3, entitled Scripts, the focus falls onto an examination of a Naxi wedding tradition. And there's palpable tension here, I think, between governmental discourse about religion and heritage and you know, things associated with these concepts, but also, you know, with the local reality. So there's this tension between what the government has in its discourse and the local reality and the local perception. So I was thinking that this tension has been a constant during the Mao era and has also continued in a certain extent to the present. And you emphasize this very very nicely and interestingly in the book. So, you know, I was curious to learn more about the ins and outs of the juxtaposition between the state and the individual practices in constructing this Naxi heritage and the Naxi wedding customs during both the Mao era, but also the post-Mao era.
Mm. This chapter calls scripts, because I think this idea of script is that it is written and it's man-made. It is also consistently rewritten, adapted to new context. And a script has a function. It guides people to act whatever their roles are. And in this book, the Naxi wedding tradition symbolizes the meanings, the scripts. So I gave you a bit very quick overview of the development of the wedding traditional Naxi wedding as a script, as a development of a script. So historically, Naxi people wedding ceremony were based on local indigenous Dongba religion. It is a bit like a pre-Tibetan Bon religion. The traditional Naxi wedding rituals are mainly directed by Dongba, who is the Dongba religious practitioners, as the god Su that refers to life and vitality. So they believe spirits, they think spirits can help them to navigate the relationship between human society and dead and spirits. So by communing with the spirits through rituals, Naxi believe the spirits Su can protect the new married couple and activate the vitality of the new household. So that was the original function or meanings of the wedding, traditional weddings. And then since the early 20th century, Han Chinese style marriage have gradually replaced the traditional Naxi ceremony in that regions. So in these reformed marriage ceremonies, the religious elements within Dongba practice was reduced, and Han Chinese practice were introduced and fused with lots of different other cultures, such as Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism. So it's a mixture. Then you might know that during the Cultural Revolution, which is 1966 to 1976, the Gongba, like other folk religion in China, was banned as superstitions. So as a result, marriage custom among the Naxi, especially in the towns and cities like Lijiang, has been further influenced by Han culture. And then, and the script is still going on, since the post-Mao era, Naxi indigenous customs, like many religious and cultural traditional culture elsewhere in China, have been officially revitalized and promoted through folk festivals and heritage program. The state has motivated to transform Dongba religious practice into a form of cultural heritage that can be objectified, collected, and displayed at museums and zine parks for inspection and consumption. So if we go through that kind of history, it's a bit like Hobsbawm's idea of invented tradition. And as a result, the state conceptualization of Naxi wedding customs has shifted from uncivilized and backward, which was branded during the Cultural Revolution, to something like authentic, ethnic, and romantic. So that's a result from the tourism industry part. But the state is not the only player in this game or scripts making. Heritage and ethnic tourism also allows other actors to do the scripts writing. The entrepreneurs, the scholars, and including the religious practitioners. They are all involved in that reinvention and rewriting of the Dongba culture scripts. So now we focus on the courtyard, which is the focus of the book. So the performance of the Naxi wedding courtyard is intertwined with the previous and the current custom of Naxi in a way that satisfies modern tourism needs. So for instance, the Dongba religious practitioners, he intentionally shortened the current ritual from the original ritual, which needed to be done for 2 days ritual, to a 10-minute ritual. Mm-hmm. The reason is simple, because the tourist doesn't have the patience to kneel down and wait for listen to a chanting for a very long time, because they are hurried, they want to do something else during their trips. That's why the whole wedding ritual is around 10 minutes, and then you include other things such as celebration, dance, and games. So the main component of the ritual is almost like a condensed abstract or index of the original rituals performed in the villages. But interestingly, the Dongba performer still believe that the god, the Su deities, exist in his ritual performance. And he thinks that his short ritual can still protect a couple of tourists, and his blessing for their future still works. So he's very proud of being a Dongba, a real Dongba, a real Dongba after that Cultural Revolution. And he's working very hard to gain that social recognition. So this gives you a quick overview of how this script is written and keep revising during that period of time.
Absolutely. And it's actually, you know, quite attractive in a way to participate, but also to listen to these things and, think more about the ways in which the shortening of a ritual, right, is supposed to have the same effect, or, the shortening might not influence the effect and thoughts like this. So, you're about to say
yes. Yeah, I'm also very fascinated about that part. That I just feel that after so many years and the Dongba, he's a bit kind of marginal minority, because there are not many Dongba religious practitioners in these areas and not very encouraged by the state, but he still has his confidence and passion in insist on his ritual efficacies or identities. I find that very fascinating part, especially in the modern kind of tourism context.
Yes, so in chapter four, local actors, we get to read more about people's stances towards heritage and tourism discourses. And I found this fascinating because the parts where people negotiate and subvert official positions in according with their memory and emotions are things that are not necessarily addressed up front. So I wanted to know more about it, and I was thinking to ask you to tell our listeners more about this local dynamic transformation and, of course, about the transgressions that are happening in Lijiang.
Sure. This chapter mainly focuses on actors in the Nashi Waiting Courtyard. And I call them actors, again, it's both metaphoric and real. And on one hand, they perform an Esti wedding as a paid service for tourists. So they are real actors. And on the other hand, actors in the metaphoric sense, they also perform their own ethnic identity under the backdrop of the dramatic development of the heritage tourism industry in Lijiang. So the stage of the courtyard serves as a social reflection of every day, where people visit and stay, as well as crave and search for different meanings of life. I found it fascinating that these local actors, despite working under the same Essen label as Naji, have various response to the state-oriented narrative of cultural heritage and ethnic tourism. So for instance, the heritage manager of the place, he used the opportunity to use Naji culture as the resources to develop his cultural industry business. While he is trying very hard to promote authentic Nashi culture, not because he's just doing that for business, but also he's proud of being an ethnic Nashi. So in another word, he's struggling between pride and price in his life. Pride on one sense is kind of like being proud of being a Nashi, and price, another one, he is trying to make business. Other senior Nashi performers also share similar kind of concerns about the dramatic change that happened in Lijiang due to the heritage and tourism industry. While they are working in the Nashi Waiting Courtyard, they also live around this area because they're a local community. They complain about the noise, the increased congestion, the traffic, the rise in the cost of living. So many express a feeling of having lost the traditional lifestyle and the community cohesion. They hope to claim or protect their own Nashi heritage when it was threatened or destroyed because of the recent modern heritage tourism development. So this form of heritage that is different from the official and industrialized version of heritage in the form of ritual performance and daily life activities evokes a sense of local pride and nostalgia. So they often found it difficult to keep up with the rapid change of the tourism dominant environment. And so most of them chose to move out the old town of Lijiang and live in a new part of the city. So there was a sense of displacement without enforcement. But different from these elder Nashi actors, young Nashi behave differently. So there's a generation gap. This young Nashi actress maintains a more relaxed and a positive attitude towards this transition. So this young generation grew up in a very modern or Han Chinese social environment. Their education and employment experience makes them less attached to their traditional ethnic and cultural background. So performing Nashi ethnicity in that Nashi wedding courtyard is part of their daily job. So they dress Nashi, they dance Nashi, they drink Nashi, but that's their job. And at the same time, these young Nashi actors are also eager to experience the modern outside world. So they often told me, for instance, that they dream of working in cities like Beijing and Shanghai, or one day they can travel to Paris for honeymoon or vacations, just like every one of us. So there's a difference between elders and young Nashi local actors responding to that state narrative of heritage and tourism industry.
Right. And I think also, and you do mention this in the book, right, the memories and the attitude, right, of seeing Lijiang transform has a different impact on the elders than it has on the younger people. And that might also influence the way they see the influx in tourists or governmental policies and things like that, right?
Yeah.
And
there also there are very diversity of the community. So there are different generation gaps. There's also gender difference, and also age kind of difference that which leads to a different kind of response to that modernization of the traditional Naxi culture, and everyone have different way of responding. So I didn't mention that, for instance, scholars also have different kind of way to do that. They are more preserving Naxi culture in a sense, almost like they view tourism as a threat to heritage. So they are using publications, research to preserving the authenticity of Naxi culture against, almost like a battle against the tourism industry. Which the tourism industry entrepreneurs is more or less promoting Naxi culture to the outsiders. So there are different kind of attitudes from the local hosts.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. And I'm assuming also there are different attitudes, right, in the guests who come, and also, you know, what happens after the wedding performance, or, you know, after a trip to Lijiang. And these two aspects are presented in chapter 5th, and the 5th chapter and the 6th chapter. The 5th chapter entitled Guests and the 6th chapter entitled After the Show. I thought they go together somehow in their approach to those who migrate to Lijiang to escape city life or are trying to pursue their own desires of romantic consumption. And, you know, my question was, who are these guests and how do they contribute to the evolution of our understanding regarding the heritage there and heritage development in general, as well as ethnic tourism?
Sure. By guests, I mainly talk about tourists and travelers who wish to experience the ethnic weddings during their honeymoon trips, and also guests like business migrants who quit their jobs, left their hometowns, or decided to move to Lijiang. And some of them got married in the Naxi wedding courtyard, not only for their family reason, but also a symbol of a new start of their life. So for them, the wedding is not just kind of a consumption experience. The wedding is real. It does matter to them as a new start, a rite of passage to their life. But maybe for the people who just heard that the first time, it's a bit strange, because this is a bit like, for instance, non-Christian Japanese tourists celebrate their wedding ceremony in American cathedrals and church, or American couples visit the United Kingdom for a Monty Python or the Holy Grail-themed wedding. Or European celebrities arrange their marriage in Fiji or Bhutan. So that's, people always laugh about these stories. But this chapter, I want to tell people that these stories are real. It has meaning to these guests. Because the stories is not only a short, maybe 2-3 hours consumption or drinking and celebration. The stories are more than that. That's why I have a chapter called After the Show. And I call these guests lifestyle migrants. Lots of them establish a temporary home in Lijiang as a reflection of their dissatisfaction of their main urban life from where they come from. The weddings at the courtyard become a start of their new home searching. And here the notion of home, or my notion of home, is not something about security, comfortableness, or originality. It refers to something like adventure, imagination, and exoticness. So they often develop their own business and local social network, serving both purpose of comfort and capital accumulation. And such romantic consumption of pleasure and happiness allow these guests to consume a new sense of home while using professional skills to enter the local tourism industries as new business people. However, while they enjoy freedom or enjoy the exotic romantic atmosphere in Lijiang and as an escape from their original urban life, these guests do not leave behind their original lifestyle, which is very materialistic or consumeristic. So their daily life is like they dine in the modern restaurant, eat cheesecakes, read and play with cats in the cafe. It's a cat's cafe. Drinking French wine in the bars, and sometimes they pay for the massage regularly. They still keep the distance from local Naxi residents. Even they live in Lijiang, they don't want to fully let go of their lifestyle they are accustomed to. So what does it mean? These guests can never become local Naxi. They are still guests. Once the magic effects of romantic consumption fade away and their pleasure is replaced by daily struggle with the local environment, various forms of discomfort and tension will arrive. So many of these guests start complaining about noisiness, crowdedness, traffic, just like those local actors, those Naxi people I mentioned in the previous chapter. Other people will complain that Lijiang does not have good education or hospitals. And as said, these people are consistently in the status of dissatisfaction of the present and desire for something in the future. So as a result, many of them keep complaining and then eventually choose to move to other place or go back to where they come from. So what does the story of these guests contribute to Lijiang? So people come and go. Well, the story of these guests does not reduce the amount of new incoming tourists with similar learning. Yes, there were still many people come to Lijiang, attracted by this place, get married, had new business, some of them had children, and then some of them leave after a while, 2-3 years, 4-5 years, if it's getting longer. Similar kinds of guests still come from Chinese cities, travel, stay for a short, long period. So the image of the town as a heritage and ethnic tourism destination almost create a cycle of people arriving and departure from Lijiang in search of romantic consumption. And for these people, it's a cycle for their life, a different stage of life. They might get sick of their jobs in the cities. They come here for a gap year or two years gap for short-term romantic consumption. And then when they feel they're unsatisfied, they'll move on to other places. Either they look for a new experience or because their children need better education or a medical welfare system in the cities.
So the waves, right, of tourism and guests, I would say, it's quite right. It's multifaceted. It's not just the 2-3 day guest, but you know, it seems that it can become elongated for a few years, or you know, or longer periods of time. But then there's also this continuous changing, right, that happens in Lijiang, and people who come to live there will bring it with them. So I'm assuming there are different types of attitudes, right, that the locals would have towards this continuous wave, yeah, of people, right?
Yeah, and interesting that most of the people who experienced this wedding in the Naxi wedding courtyard was that those I call lifestyle migrants who came to Lijiang, stayed longer. Of course, there are also other travelers or tourists stay there for 2-3 days or 1 week. This for them, it's just a short kind of reflection of their short-term experience there. There were some foreigners also got married there, even after 50 years wedding. And for them, it's a bit weird why I got married after 50 years marriage. But they still had fun doing that kind of exotic culture experience. They still laugh about that after many years. They show their photos on the Facebook page. It's an interesting kind of reflection. And there are also local national communities. Some of them also got married there. They are a young generation of Nashi. They like to try different experience, which is a bit strange from the old generation of Nashi communities. But some people do want to experience some new kind of style of wedding, even they know this is mainly for the tourists.
Right. Yeah, I definitely during my master degree studies in China, I definitely heard a few of my colleagues who it remained at the level of a dream, but, you know, saying I'm going to quit my studies and I'm going to quit, you know, everything and I'll go, to Yunnan and, become a waitress there or become, something, you know, I'll become an entrepreneur in that area. So I think it does have this this attraction, and it's constructed, right? It's a constructed thing, but also this dissemination of information and dissemination of the romantic dream that happens in day-to-day life, or through books or through the TV, I would assume. Yeah, and I think in the conclusions, in the conclusion chapter, right, in the seventh chapter, you bring everything together in an open conversation about a continuous search that happens for authenticity, modernity, emotional and cultural needs, desires, and so on. And you structure the book as a mirror, right, that reflects a performance. And my question here regards, to use a familiar language, the long-lasting impact and influence of the show, the quote-unquote show. So, what are some of these impacts and influences? Also, the conclusions you arrived at after following Li Jiang's metamorphosis.
Yeah. The conclusion. I'm not sure if you might have noticed or you get that that the structure of the book, the guests, the host or local actors, and the idea of consumption and identity, I'm not sure if you get that it's a bit like the American science fiction and TV series Westworld, particularly the season one. The Nashi Wedding Courtyard, or more general, the city of Lijiang, is probably like a Chinese version of the stage Westworld. Even it's also located in the west part of China. And just like what Delos, if you saw that season one, you know that one of the main hosts of Westworld keep asking, I think the key question, or if you want to talk about conclusion of the book, is about authenticity. So Delos is always asking, am I real, or is the whole thing real? So people might ask when they saw this book, are these wedding reels? Are these people real Nashi and Dongba religious practitioners? Or some people, after experience the wedding, or they after 4 or 5 years stay in Lijiang, they might ask, is my experience real? Just like what your friends who went to Lijiang and did 2-3 years, or maybe not that long, maybe 2-3 months as a waiter or waitress, and they might ask, is that real for me? So I think all of these issues matter to them, both, if I use the Westward term, hosts and guests. It matters to them because these people, both hosts and guests, work very hard to make the experience so strong, so tense, and so real. But at the same time, life and living environments change so fast. Lijiang changed so fast in the last couple of decades. So it's very difficult for them to seize the present and continue to search, to struggle, and to chase for better life. They witness people come and go. We see information come and go, and also infrastructure has been destroyed and bureaucrated. A lot of new hotels and guest houses. There's so many things going on in Lijiang. So for the house, for instance, wedding, romance, and happiness become the daily jobs. It is real, but it's repeating. Just like in Delo's question, is it real? After the whole day busy laughing and a celebration of other people's wedding, is it real for me? That's a question to the same host in the courtyard. And for the guests, the romantic consumption offers them very powerful, but also instant gratification. So in that sense, everything seems a bit like an illusion. So after they celebrate the wedding, after they stay for 2-3 months, or some of them for 2-3 years, they're not sure what does it really mean to their whole life, like a dream. So I believe the dilemma between real and illusion probably reflects something about modernity and our modern life in general. So it's not only about Lijiang or China, but I guess everywhere. It's something we can think about. But I also like to address that Westward is not a pure happy land. I guess if you saw season one of Westward, there was a very popular quote, which Westward quoted from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, that these violent delights have violent ends. So in Lijiang, same, that I saw so many romantic stories, love stories, people got married, people happy. But the story of Lijiang is full of both romance and violence in a symbolic way. That here in Lijiang, we should not forget that the tension and the politics is also real. So not only this laughing and happiness and roses, but we are talking about heritage and tourism industry, or more broadly, the capitalism and ethnic politics leads to dramatic transformation of the place and also people's daily life. That includes social stratification, gentrification, displacement, exploration, and a lot of times heartbreaking. So I saw so many people happy, excited about this place, but then they broke up, or they had to be forced to leave the place because of living costs or many other reasons. There's a tension between the young generation and also local residents, the tension between Han Chinese and ethnic minorities, and all of this because of the whole development of heritage and ethnic tourism industry. So if you like to ask me what's the conclusion, I think there are two things here. One is the question of authenticity, reflects something about our modern life. And another thing is the politics of heritage and tourism, which we often forget that the beauty, the violent delights sometimes have violent ends.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And I would love to ask you way more, but I'm afraid we've taken a lot of your time. So I was wondering whether you could tell us more about your current projects.
Sure. I just had a new book out last year on heritage politics in China. So I look at how the nation used the past to shape national image and international influence. But this is a look at more abroad from the whole country and look at how general the heritage politics in China. And these days, I make some movement of shifts. If I think about my start from Lijiang, which focused on happiness and romance, so these days I move from happiness and romance to dark heritage sites that are associated with wars and post-conflict sites, and also move from consumption to commemoration. So it's a kind of dramatic change. I'm interested in memory politics, or more broadly, how nation state forget and erase certain difficult or problematic past for nation beauty, and how local communities use private museums or commemorative practice to shape social memories from below. I think there's still a kind of connected with my previous experience, or for instance, like this book in Lijiang, because there was a lot of commemoration going on. Even the color, I mean, you always prefer to use color. It's different. The taste is different. There was in Lijiang, there was a lot of romance. And now often we talk about darkness here. But I think there's some kind of connection with my present project.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, of course, the, you know, the experience and, you know, the methods and everything that you've seen unfolding in your previous projects, I'm sure it it informs, right, and feeds into the current projects that you have. And I'm very excited, and I'm very looking forward to reading more of your work. And, you know, hopefully we'll meet again into an interview for New Books Network for projects. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Zhu, and to wish you all the best in your project and, you know, a good 2021, I hope.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you very much, Victoria. And I really be honored to be here and talk with you. And I hope really all the best with you and with other people who is listening to this interview.